Okay, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation. So the title of my talk is Cognitive Products as Artifacts. So this will immediately raise questions, I think. So first of all, what is a cognitive product? So cognitive products are the things we refer to as, for example, John's claim that it is raining, or John's thought that it is raining, or John's judgment that it is raining, or also John's request to leave, or John's offer to stay. The view that I want to defend is the view according to which cognitive products are really on a par with artifacts. So artifacts are things like chairs and tables and houses, but they're also artifacts that are poems, and laws are artifacts. And I want to defend the view that, for example, John's thought that Mary is happy, this cognitive product is nothing but the non-physical artifact that's produced by the act of thinking on the part of John. So cognitive products like thoughts, judgments, assertions, requests, decisions, plans, they are entirely on a par with artifacts. They fall under the more general ontological category of artifacts. Then the next question is, well, why are cognitive products important? So actually, not many philosophers talk about cognitive products. There's one philosopher in the history of philosophy that made the notion of a cognitive product important, namely Twardowski, but in general, philosophers do not talk about cognitive products. So why do I think that cognitive products should be important? So I think they are very important in philosophy of language. And in fact, they should be attributed a central role in philosophy of language, in particular for attitude reports like 1A, John thinks that Mary is happy. So on my view, this sentence is really about John's thought, and it's not, which is a cognitive product, which is something concrete, which is something produced by John. The sense is not about something more abstract, namely what on the standard view is considered a proposition. I'll come to that in a minute. So I think cognitive products are really to be viewed as the primary bearers of truth values, and some cognitive products like requests permissions may not have truth values or truth conditions, but they have satisfaction conditions. So in any case, cognitive products are entities that have truth conditions or satisfaction conditions, and I take them to be really the primary bearers of truth conditions or satisfaction conditions. And so they are much more concrete than what is standardly considered the primary bearer of truth conditions in philosophy of language, namely propositions. I think there's really good evidence from natural language that cognitive products play this role of being the primary bearers of truth or satisfaction conditions and being central to the semantics of attitude reports like John thinks that Mary is happy. And also cognitive products are, if they are just artifacts, they fall under something that we already accept, artifacts. So artifacts are everywhere in our social ontology. So not just material artifacts like tables, chairs, books, but also we accept works of art and laws and rules. They are artifacts. And so on this view, cognitive products are just a special case of artifacts. So this would put a central notion of philosophy of language then within a more general category that we need anyway. Yeah, so I will start with the standard view in philosophy of language according to which propositions play a central role and not cognitive products. So what is the standard view that relates to propositions? So let us look at 1A, so an attitude report. John thinks that Mary is happy. So the standard view in philosophy of language, and in fact also philosophy of mind, is that this sentence describes a relation between John and then something else. And that something else is given by the that clause that Mary is happy. And that is generally considered a proposition. So on the standard view, think expresses a relation between agents, like John, and propositions, like the proposition that Mary is happy. And the proposition is generally considered the kind of thing the that clause stands for or refers to. So the logical form of 1A is then the one given in 1B. So we have the think relation, it iterates John to what that Mary is stands that sorry, what that Mary is happy stands for, namely a proposition. And the standard view, in fact, takes this logical form really to be displayed by the by what seems to be explicit in the sentence. So it seems think relates, has two arguments, John and that Mary is happy, and that Mary is happy should stand for something. It should be a proposition, and so it seems we are sort of forced to make use of propositions as in 1B, given what seems to be the semantics of the sentence in 1A. So what are propositions? Propositions are entities that should play certain roles. So propositions, first of all, are considered the primary bearers of truth values. So the proposition that Mary is happy is true just in case Mary is happy, and it's false just in case Mary is not happy. And then propositions are also the sorts of things that are considered the meanings of sentences. And then in particular, the sorts of things that embedded sentences like that clauses stand for. So the sentence Mary is happy expresses a proposition. The that clause that Mary is happy stands for a proposition. That is basically the standard view that one can find in the literature. And then given that propositional attitudes like think are relations between agents and propositions, propositions then also play this role of being the contents of attitudes or in fact the objects of attitudes. So the way an attitude report like John thinks that Mary is happy is analyzed in 1B is one where the proposition is really taken to be the object of the propositional attitude that the agent John relates to in the think relation. So that's a standard view. So propositions are things that have truth conditions, and then in addition, they are also supposed to be things that can be shared among different agents. So John and Bill may both think that Mary is happy, so here it seems as a single proposition that John relates to in the think relation and that Bill relates to in the think relation. And then we can conclude John and Bill think the same thing. So there seems to be a single thing that's shared between John and Bill, and that's a proposition. And so propositions, it seems, need to be agent independent and mind independent. They can't be something that's located in the mind of one particular agent, because it's something that needs to be shareable among different agents. So Frege is a philosopher that was famous for having advanced this notion of a proposition as an entity that's abstract, that has truth conditions, and is mind and agent independent. So it's something that can be shared with different agents. Now, a number of philosophers think that propositions conceived in this way as abstract entities that have truth conditions and play the role of the contents of propositional attitudes like the thinking relation, propositions in this sense are problematic. And for mainly two reasons. So first of all, if propositions are abstract entities somewhere in a third realm, in Plato 7 or so, how can they act as the contents of mental attitudes like thinking? So how can they possibly act as the contents of attitudes? How can agents grasp propositions if they are purely abstract objects? So this is the problem of how propositions can be cognitively grasped by agents. And then there's another problem, and that is that is a problem of how propositions, if they are abstract entities, how can they have truth conditions? How can they be truth-directed? So there are different conceptions of propositions as abstract objects that have been proposed by philosophers. So in particular, some philosophers, a lot of philosophers actually have pursued the view that propositions are sets of possible worlds or maybe situations. But then how can a set just be true or false? So one needs to stipulate something like a set of worlds is true just in case the actual world is in that set or so. But a set as such isn't necessarily like truth directed. There's another view of propositions according to which, let's say, the proposition that Mary is happy is a structured kind of thing. Let's say here just the pair consisting of the property of being happy and Mary. So it's an abstract object that's a pair consisting of two things, a property and an individual. Now, if propositions are conceived in that way, again, the problem arises, how can they have truth conditions? Why should a pair be true or false? So why should the pair consisting of happiness and Mary be true just in case Mary is happy, and false just in case Mary is not happy? So there's nothing in the pair itself that tells us that this pair is true or false under those circumstances. And then also, why should a pair be true at all? So this is a problem of the truth-directedness of propositions, and then also the unity of propositions. So why propositions, if they're structured things, should have the particular truth conditions they're meant to have. So it seems the only thing one can do is stipulate that this abstract thing, the pair, is true just in case the property that is part of the pair holds, in fact, in the actual world of the individual that's also part of the pair. But that's not something that's in the nature of this pair. So these are two important problems that at least a number of philosophers think are really serious problems for the abstract notion of a proposition. And then some philosophers have proposed an alternative account of propositions, where propositions are now conceived in a more cognitive sort of way. And this is, so in particular, Scott Soames and Peter Hanks, two contemporary philosophers, have proposed such an alternative, namely according to which propositions are replaced by types of cognitive acts. And the cognitive acts are acts of predication. So the proposition that Mary is happy is identified with the type of cognitive act that predicates happiness of Mary. That is, it's a type of act where that act is an act of an agent predicating the property of being happy of Mary. And so the view is, if you take propositions to be made up of these cognitive acts of predication, you start out with a cognitive entity, a cognitive act. So you no longer then have this problem of the graspability of propositions. And then also the view is that an act of predicating a property of an object, such an act is inherently truth-directed. So when an agent predicates a property of an object, he or she aims at truth. So the view is, if you identify propositions with types of acts of predication, you solve the two serious problems for the abstract notion of a proposition. So this is basically the state of the art on the notion of a proposition. Now, I think there is a serious problem with this alternative view that replaces abstract propositions by types of acts. And that is that acts intuitively are just not the sorts of things that are true or false. So we just wouldn't say that an act of predicating happiness of Mary is true or false, as we wouldn't say that an act of thinking is true or false, as we wouldn't say that an act of judging is true or false. We would say that a judgment is true or false, but not the act of judging. Or similarly, we wouldn't say that a speech act of asserting is true or false. We don't say that speech act was true. But we would say an assertion is true or false, or a claim is true or false. So I think acts are really not the sorts of things that would be suitable truth bearers, because it's very counterintuitive to take acts and consider them to be true or false. So it's just forcing them into a role that they by nature just do not have. Just like abstract propositions were forced into a role of having truth conditions, which it seems by nature they cannot have if they are abstract mathematical objects. And then there are other issues, I think, with this act-based view of propositions, which I don't want to discuss here. So I want to focus on a new way of conceiving of the sorts of things that should play the role of propositions, namely conceiving of them not as acts, but as products of acts, namely as cognitive products of acts. So rather than taking an act of judging to be something that plays the role of propositions or a type of such things, it will be the judgment, which is the cognitive product of the act of judging. So it will be the judgment that will be the thing that plays the role of a truth bearer and that plays the other roles that propositions were meant to play, more or less. So the new approach that I want to pursue then is that instead of taking propositions to the roles of propositions to be played by cognitive acts, they should be played by cognitive products of cognitive acts. And these cognitive products should be understood as the artifacts that result from those acts, that are produced by those acts, whereby an artifact need not be physically or materially realized. It can be a sort of abstract artifact in the sense of not being a materially realized artifact. So philosophy, there are philosophers that talk about artifacts and also abstract artifacts. So Amy Thomason is famous for having introduced the notion of an abstract artifact. So for example, a fictional character, on her view, is an abstract artifact. It's created at some point, it depends on an agent, but what makes it abstract is that it is not materially realized, it's not physically realized, so it's not something you can touch as you can touch like a table that is an artifact. So there are artifacts that lack a material or physical realization, and in that sense, they are called abstract. They're not called abstract because they are like mathematical objects or eternal objects, but they are abstract because they lack a physical realization. So cognitive products to a great extent are abstract artifacts produced by cognitive acts. Now let's then look at some more examples of cognitive products. In fact, one can should make a distinction among three kinds of cognitive products, and first of all, have a more narrow cognitive category of cognitive products in the narrow sense. So these are products of cognitive like mental acts like thinking or judging or deciding. So John thought that S is, let's say John thought that Mary is happy, that is a cognitive product produced by John's act of thinking. John's judgment that Mary is happy is a cognitive product produced by John's act of judging. John's decision to leave is a cognitive product produced by John's act of deciding. So here we have mental acts that produce things which in turn are then cognitive products. They are the abstract artifacts produced by those mental acts. And then we have also what one can call elocutionary products. So these are the products of speech acts. And they may then have an auditory physical realization, but they do not have a material realization, unless one talks about like the product of an act of writing, which does have a physical, a material realization. So John's claim that Mary is happy is then the elocutionary product of the speech act that's John's claiming that Mary is happy. So the speech act doesn't have the relevant properties. It's not something that could be true or false. The product, John's claim that Mary is happy, can be true or false. Then John's demand that Mary, let's say that Mary leave, that will also be an elocutionary product. It will be the elocutionary product that is produced by the speech act of requesting, demanding. And so the speech act itself can't be said to be satisfied or not, but the product, the demand, is something that can be satisfied or not, or fulfilled or not, or executed or not. So the demand, the product, has satisfaction conditions, not the act. And then there are, there's a third category that I want to distinguish, which I think is actually a very interesting one. And I think it plays an important role for the semantics of modal sentences, that is, sentences of the sort John may take an apple or John must leave. So may and must are modal verbs. And they are similar in a number of ways to attitude verbs like think or decide. But there are differences as well. Now, I think that sentences with modal verbs involve a semantics that where modal products play a central role. So what are modal products? Modal products are, for example, John's obligation to help, or the permission for John to leave, or the offer to stay, or the need to leave. So here we have at least a number of terms in English with which we can refer to these things that I call modal products: an obligation, a permission, an offer, a need, an invitation, and so. Now these things also have satisfaction conditions. So John's obligation to help may be satisfied or not. An offer to stay may be accepted or not, and the acceptance is sort of the satisfaction of the offer. So modal products are like the products of elocutionary acts of requesting, in that they have satisfaction conditions. So at least modal products of the deontic sort, like obligations, permissions, and so on. And what is special about modal products is that they may actually last much longer than the elocutionary products. So if John requested that Mary leaves, then he produced the request that Mary leaves. But when the act of requesting is over, then intuitively the request is no longer there. But still, Mary may still be under the obligation to leave. So there's a modal product that's produced by this very same act of requesting, namely the obligation on the part of Mary, which may last much longer than the illocutionary product that's a request. But Mary's obligation and the request have the same satisfaction conditions. So there's an intimate connection, but they have different conditions of persistence. So the view then is cognitive products and elocutionary products are abstract artifacts produced by cognitive and elocutionary acts, and also modal products are abstract artifacts produced by, for example, elocutionary acts, like acts of requesting or permission. So they are abstract in the sense of not having a material realization. Now, when we look at the category of artifacts in general, then we can also see that there are quite a few kinds of artifacts that are abstract artifacts. So I already mentioned Amy Thomason's example of fictional characters, which are abstract artifacts for her. But there are lots of other sorts of artifacts that may be abstract in that sense. So a poem that somebody composed but didn't write down is also an abstract artifact. And the poem is different from the act of composing the poem. So the poem may be beautiful or not, but the act of composing isn't what we would evaluate when we evaluate something aesthetically in that respect. A musical composition that hasn't been performed is an abstract artifact. And again, so it's the composition that's the subject of aesthetic evaluation, not the act of composing it. A personal rule that hasn't been written down would be an abstract artifact. And it has normative properties, so it has behavior-guiding properties. And in that respect, it is like, it's like a modal product. And then there are uncast statues that may be abstract artifacts and electronic files. So with artifacts, it's quite natural that we may have examples that lack a physical realization. And then there are also artifacts that have multiple physical realizations, like bronze statues or books or musical compositions that have been performed several times. Now, when we have these examples of cognitive products and elocutionary products, it seems the distinction between the product and the act is quite tied to natural language. So we have the term thinking that describes an act, and the term John's thought that Mary is happy, which describes a product. And that might give rise to worries. So there's a distinction here with like one sort of term, thinking, which is a gerundive term, describing acts, and another one describing products. Maybe it's too tied to natural language to really consider it an ontological distinction. However, when we look at other artifacts, we see that there are very clear cases where we accept the distinction in everyday life that's not at all tied to particular linguistic terms. So like a law is a very important kind of artifact that may be abstract or written down. And the law is of course something that's completely different from the act of establishing the law, the act of declaring it or passing it. So the law can be obeyed or not, or followed or not, not the act of passing it or declaring it. So the law is a thing that has satisfaction conditions, not the act. So here the distinction is very sharp. It's not tied to linguistic terms in language, strictly at least. And then also similarly with works of art. So a work of art is the carrier of aesthetic properties and properties of representation, maybe. And it's not the act of creating it that is the bearer of these sorts of properties. And again, here we have a very sharp distinction between the act of artistic creation and the product of the artistic creation, where the product may be an abstract artifact. And the distinction is not tied to particular terms in natural language. So the view then is that thoughts, judgments, claims, decisions, requests, answers, questions, and so on, all these things are entirely on a par with other sorts of artifacts. It's just that they are produced by, let's say, particularly simple acts, not quite complex acts like acts of artistic creation or maybe the acts that are involved for establishing a law. But rather, we have simpler acts. But otherwise, these things are entirely on a par with artifacts in general. Now, some cognitive products may be enduring. So first of all, cognitive products of acts of writing, which may be elocutionary acts, will be enduring. So the products of writing will endure. So they are materially realized. Or and then also modal products, as I already mentioned. Modal products differ from elocutionary and cognitive products in that they can naturally endure way past the act that established them or produced them. And in fact, in that respect, modal products are entirely on a par with laws. So once a law is passed or declared, it is something that endures naturally way beyond the act of establishing it. And so, in fact, laws are entirely, I think, on a par with modal products of the sort of obligations, offers, permissions, invitations, and so on. And they have the same sort of endurance, ability to endure. So we then have this category of cognitive products, and this category naturally comes with normative or representational properties or like satisfaction or truth conditions. And so it is then very natural to take those things to play the role that propositions should play. But we can here just appeal to something that falls under the more general category of artifacts, which we need anyway, we accept anyway. Everybody accepts works of art and laws, at least in normal everyday life. So the question then is, well, why didn't philosophers latch onto this category already? So why did philosophers focus on like these abstract objects when they tried to find something that would play the role of propositions? Or then perhaps actions like acts of predication or types of acts. Why did they not come up with the category of cognitive products? So I think this has to do with a standard view in contemporary ontology or modern ontology, namely to strictly focus on three categories of entities, namely first the category of actions or events or states, then second, the category of material objects, and then third, the category of abstract objects. So what could play the role of propositions could be abstract objects. We have seen this is problematic. So if that doesn't work, then all that remains is, since propositions couldn't possibly be material objects, all that remains is acts or maybe types of acts, given the standard view of ontology. And the standard view just has largely neglected the category of artifacts. So artifacts are by nature things that are created by an agent, and by nature they are things that have the ability to have representational or normative properties, and they are also arguably mind and agent dependent. So in particular, cognitive products are dependent on a particular agent. And so like John's claim that Mary is happy, that's something that depends on John. So it's cognitive products are particulars. They're created, produced by an agent at some point. And they depend for their identity on that agent. And that's arguably something that goes along with artifacts in general. Artifacts are not abstract, they're dependent on a particular agent. Now, there's one important historical predecessor to the distinction between actions and products, and that is the Polish philosopher Kazimierz Twardowski. So Twardowski was a philosopher that worked in early analytic philosophy in the Warsaw Law School of Early Analytic Philosophy. And he really argued for the distinction between actions and products and took products, that is cognitive products, to be the things that play a central role for the notion of content. They play a central role for Twardowski in philosophy of language and more generally the humanities. Twardowski focused on the linguistic distinction, but he really meant that distinction to play a crucial philosophical role. And then for Twardowski, cognitive products have two important properties. First of all, they are bearers of truth conditions, or more generally, satisfaction conditions. And then, moreover, they enter similarity relations strictly on the basis of being the same in content. So how do we see this? So we can talk about John's thought and Mary's thought. And we can talk about John's thought being the same as Mary's. Now, if John's thought and Mary's thought refer to cognitive products, they cannot literally be the same, identical, in the sense of being identical, but they can be the same in the sense of being exactly similar. And the same as applies, in fact, to cognitive products, just in case they are the same, so to speak, in content. So cognitive products are exactly similar, just as in case they are the same in content. And in that respect, again, cognitive products differ from the acts. So for John's thinking to be the same as Mary's, more needs to be the case than John just having the same thought as Mary. So the same things need to be going on in their minds and so on for their thinking to be the same. So let's then look at the properties that cognitive products can have. And here we can simply look at the predicates in natural language that naturally apply to terms for cognitive products. So I'll just mention it rather quickly to not spend too much time on this. So first, cognitive products may have truth and satisfaction conditions. So we can see this in 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So is true, is false, applies to cognitive products, but not to the corresponding actions. Was fulfilled, was complied with, applies to products, not actions. Now, and then was executed, so a command can be executed. An act of commanding cannot be executed. It's impossible to do that. So with some of the predicates, we see particularly sharp distinctions. So acts are not things that have satisfaction conditions. Products do. And then some predicates like John follow apply to the two things, but they have mean very different things then. So John followed Mary's advice in 6a means Mary's advice was satisfied by what John did. John follows Mary's, followed Mary's activity of advising, that means something completely different. So that means sort of John observed Mary while she was advising or so. It doesn't mean that he satisfied her advice or followed her advice. Then in 4.3, we see again the way cognitive products enter similarity relations. In 13, we see that the is of identity doesn't really apply to cognitive products of distinct agents. So John's thought is Mary's thought. That sense doesn't seem to be able to be true. And that's because John's thought is particular to John. Mary's thought is particular to Mary. So we have distinct cognitive products. That's something that natural language displays. So cognitive products are particular to particular agents. They can only be similar in content. So John's thought can be the same as Mary's, but they cannot be numerically identical. Then cognitive products can also cause things in virtue of their content. So 14a, John's answer caused surprise. Here it's the content of the answer that somehow was causally responsible for the surprise. John's giving an answer caused surprise. Here it's no longer the content that matters, but merely the act. Then cognitive products and the corresponding actions also differ in their part-whole structure. Again, natural language shows us this very clearly. So in section 4.5, we have like part of John's decision. John's decision is a cognitive product. When we talk about part of John's decision, what are we talking about? We are talking about part of the content of the decision. Now, if we talk about part of John's action of deciding, so part of his deliberation or something, then we in fact talk about a very different sort of part, a temporal part of an action, and that's completely different. So cognitive products have a part-whole structure that consists in like partial content that's driven by content entirely, whereas the corresponding actions have the part-whole structure of actions and events, like temporal parts. A part of an action is a temporal part. A part of a product, like a part of a judgment, a claim, an answer, so it's a content-related part. And here the intuition, again, is very, very sharp. And then in addition to attributing to cognitive products, truth or satisfaction conditions, why it may attribute to them entities that make them true or satisfy them. And in fact, this is a view one can find in John Searle's work on intentionality. And it's something that relates to also Kit Fine's recent work on truth-maker semantics. So when we have John's claim that Mary is happy, then we have something that's made true by situations in which Mary is in fact happy. And when we have John's decision to leave, then we have something that is satisfied or implemented by John's action of leaving. So some products are satisfied by actions and others are made true by situations. Now, when one looks at the various sorts of products there are, one will notice that we also have the same sorts of terms for what seem to be products of states, like John's belief, that is, or John's intention to do something, or John's fear or hope, that is. Here one may have worries and about this general view. How is the notion of a cognitive product applicable to something that relates to a state and not an action? Now here are different approaches one might take. So one could view a belief as a product that in fact results from an action. But the action wouldn't be like a believing, it would be something like a judgment that put some representation in somebody's belief box, or it would be behavior that is constitutive of a disposition that we can then somehow identify as a belief. Also, the different views that one finds actually in the philosophical literature about belief that would allow considering beliefs to be the products of actions of some sort. But one could also alternatively say, well, a belief is not really a product in the way a thought or a judgment is a product of an act, yet a belief has the very same properties as a thought or a judgment. So it has a part structure driven by partial content, it is mind and agent dependent, it enters similarity relations on the basis of being the same in content, and so it really shares exactly the same characteristic properties of cognitive or illocutionary products. So one can then say, well, here we wouldn't make a distinction between belief states and beliefs, let's just take beliefs and have them play the same role that thoughts and judgments play. We just do not make a distinction between actions and products here. So then we can look at that role in a little more detail. That is, what is the role of cognitive products in the semantics of attitude reports of the sort John thought that Mary is happy? So there's a fairly widespread view in semantics according to which verbs like think or walk or run have an additional argument position, namely for an action or an event. So John walked in the park, so there's a walking event, it's in the park. So in the park is a predicate of this walking event. That's a Davidsonian view of action sentences, and it's a Davidsonian view of the semantic function of adverbials. Now one can take this view, apply to attitude verbs like think, then posit an additional argument position for an event of thinking. And that is now very helpful in order to give a role to cognitive products in the semantics of attitude reports. So we can look now at 16. So John thought that S, where S is like Mary is happy or whatever. So now the idea is think can now be viewed as a relation between actions and agents. And this action can be mapped onto its product. The product is a thought. The action is an act of thinking. And that S, so like that Mary is happy, has the function of characterizing the product, basically specifying its truth or satisfaction conditions. So the logical form of an attitude report like 16A can then be given as in 16B. That is, there is an action that is a thinking on the part of John, and that S characterizes the product of the action. That is, it characterizes John's thought. So John thought that S is analyzed like John has the thought that S, basically. Now I think that S, like that Mary is happy, can actually express various properties of products. Maybe it can be used so to characterize the structure of the product of that is a thought, as in 17b, but it can certainly also be used to just specify the satisfiers or truth makers of a product. That's what we would certainly need for like 18a. John implicitly believes that Mary is happy, so we can see that John always looks happy when he sees, John is somehow relieved because Mary is happy or whatever. So we can attribute to John a belief that is maybe only an implicit belief. It's something that matches his behavior. So in that case, we wouldn't want to the that clause to attribute any structure to the belief. The that clause here just specifies the satisfiers or truth makers of the product. And that's done in 18C. So senses, that clauses express properties of products as in 18B, namely that the satisfiers of the products are those that make the sentence as true. That's roughly what that says. Now, for those that are interested in how I would deal with, like, John and Bill thought the same thing, if John thought that Mary is happy and Bill thought that Mary is happy, I think that the same thing or something or so, these sorts of quantifiers actually quantify over products or kinds of them. And a kind of product is something that has instances that are exactly similar, so are the same in content. Now we can briefly turn to modal sentences, which will involve modal products, that is, entities of the sort of obligations, permissions, offers, invitations, needs, and so on. So these entities, as I already said, have satisfaction conditions. So John's obligation is something that can be satisfied by an action. But an obligation can actually also be violated by an action, namely if John does something that makes that is incompatible with the fulfillment of the obligation. So obligations have both satisfiers and what one may call violators. So an obligation can be violated just like a law can be violated. A law is also something that generally has satisfiers and violators. But some modal products have, in fact, only satisfiers. And these are modal products of possibility. So on my view, modal products of necessity, like obligations, needs, and so on, have both satisfiers and violators. And modal products of possibility, like offers, invitations, permissions, they only have satisfiers. And I think that's very intuitive. So if I give someone permission to do something, all I do is create options for that person, create possibilities. I don't prohibit anything, I just create options. And that means the permission or an offer or an invitation is something that has just satisfiers and not violators. So with this view of modal products, we can then have a new semantics of modal sentences. So John must help. It's a simple modal sentence. Here we have the modal must. And I here just would say that the modal has an implicit argument for a modal product, like an obligation. So there is an object E, like in 21b, that's an obligation. And now John help, that sort of sentence, serves to characterize the obligation. How does it do it? Well, it specifies both the satisfiers and the violators of the obligation. That would be the view. Now we can look at a modal sense of possibility, 22a, John may leave. So here, may is a modal of possibility. And it will, on this view, now have exactly the same semantics. And that's totally non-standard, because the standard view in philosophy is that you have universal quantification involved in 21A, ranging like universal quantifier ranging over worlds. In 22A, you would have existential quantification over worlds. So now we have a totally different analysis, completely non-standard, but I think it's very simple and it just makes use of these modal products. So in 22B, what is stated here is a modal product of permission, E. And John Leaf specifies the satisfiers and violators of this modal product, the permission. Now, in this case, we actually have only satisfiers. So all that John Leaf does is specify the satisfiers. And so this is all we need. We no longer need to make use of quantification over worlds and then existential and universal quantification, distinguishing must and may. In 23, I have the more general semantics of like embedded senses or senses in general as expressing properties of products, specifying both their satisfiers and violators. So if a product has only satisfiers, then the sense will only specify the satisfiers. If the product has satisfiers and violators, the sense will specify the two sorts of things. It comes out automatically, but just by what the product has. Two more minutes, okay. So this would be the general semantics of modal sentences, entirely analogous to attitude reports, making use of the same sort of ontology, namely of modal products. Now, there are interesting connections between attitude reports and modal sentences that can be accounted for immediately on this view. So, for example, there are inferences one can make from attitude reports to modal sentences. So when we have 24A, John asked Mary to leave, we can infer, in a way, 24B, Mary must leave. So what that means is John asked Mary to leave. Here, John does an illocutionary act that produces an illocutionary product, the request. But the illocutionary act also produces a modal product, namely an obligation. And that's Mary's obligation. That's what is involved in the semantics of 24b. In 25a, John offered Mary an apple. Again, John does an illocutionary act. It produces an illocutionary product of an offer, but it also produces a modal product, like an offer that will still be there tomorrow and after tomorrow that Mary will have for days to come. And that modal product will be involved in 25b with May. In 27 through 30, we see very clearly that modal products have like the ability to endure beyond the act that created them. Unlike illocutionary products. Now, one can also easily account for performative uses of illocutionary verbs and modal verbs. So I can produce a request by uttering the sentence, "I hereby ask you to leave." Now, on this view that I've outlined, this means by uttering the sentence, I produce an illocutionary product, a request. But I could, in a way, do the same thing by saying, "You must leave," if I'm in the right position of authority. And here, "must" is also used in a performative sort of way. When uttering that sentence, then produce a modal product, that's the obligation on the part of the addressee to leave. So here I can make use of the same a view of here I can say the sentences express properties of illocutionary products or modal products which are predicated of the products of the utterance. And the utterance can result in both the illocutionary product and the modal product. And now, just a final remark, we can look at these peculiar uses of modals in sentences 35a, b, and c. John requested that Mary should leave. Why do we have a should here? John may just have said to Mary, leave, and not use should. Or John offered Mary that she could use the house. John may just have said, use the house or so. Why do we have the could here? So on this view I have sketched of the performative uses of modals, we have an immediate account of this. So here we have just a performative use of a modal in an embedded sentence. And that Mary should leave expresses a property of modal products being implicit arguments of should and having satisfiers and violators as specified by the sentence Mary leaves. And so here the that clause is predicated of the modal product that's produced by the act of requesting. And that's how we account for the use of the modal here. So these sorts of examples are a major puzzle to the standard view of the standard analysis of modals. So I don't want to go into the details here, but so I think a lot of puzzling phenomena involving modals are immediately accounted for on this new view, according to which modals are predicates of modal products. Yeah, so that's it.